Okay, thanks. Well, first of all, I have to say jet lag is a terrible thing for scientists. So I woke up at 2 this morning. So I'm not in my best shape, but I'll try my best, you know, to be clear and stuff. So, but forgive me if things get a little blurry at times. Anyhow, this is an outline of the talk. So first, I will start with an observational overview to give you, to provide you with some background for the rest of the talk. And I will start with the observational situation in our own galaxy, and then I'll say a few words about the situation in external galaxies. Then I will tackle the important problem of the origin of galactic magnetic fields. First, I would like to show you why, or maybe remind you why, galactic magnetic fields cannot simply be of primordial origin. And then, well, I suppose most of you are familiar with this notion, but still I think it's worth going through the detailed reasoning. And then I will focus on dynamos. I will start by the alpha effect, describing the physics of the alpha effect in the case of galaxies. Then I will explain physically how the dynamo works, again, in the case of galaxies. And then I will touch upon the problem of seed magnetic fields, that is, the field, the seed field that is required to trigger dynamo action. And then I will discuss models of galactic dynamos, mainly the mean field dynamo theory, and I will present you the main results that are obtained through these models. So let me start with the observational situation. Well, historically, the interstellar magnetic field in our galaxy was discovered through the observation that starlight is linearly polarized. And the interpretation of this phenomenon is that the interstellar medium contains a coherent magnetic field which tends to align dust grains. So let me take this bottle. If that's an elongated dust grain, the dust grains will be aligned perpendicular to magnetic field lines. And of course, these elongated and aligned dust grains will tend to block the component of the light that is parallel to their long axis, that is, the component perpendicular to the magnetic field. And only the other component that's parallel to the field lines will go through. And so as a result, the starlight that reaches us is linearly polarized in the direction of the field. So of course, by measuring the direction of the starlight, of polarized starlight, you will get immediately the direction of the magnetic field on the plane of the sky. So using this method, we now know that in the vicinity of the sun, the magnetic field is horizontal. That is, it's mainly in the plane of the galaxy. And it is nearly in the azimuthal direction. There is about an angle of 7 degrees between the direction of the field and the azimuthal direction. Now, this method obviously gives you only the direction of the field. But there are a number of methods that also or only give you the magnetic field strength. For instance, in neutral regions, there people make Zeeman splitting measurements. So in principle, the amount of Zeeman splitting is directly proportional to the magnetic field strength. But in practice, the splitting is so small that it cannot be measured directly. So what is measured instead is the circular polarization, or if you will, the Stokes parameter V. And that is directly proportional to the line of sight component of the field. But either way, with this kind of measurements, we now know that in atomic clouds, the magnetic field strength is about, well, typically several microgauss with a median value of 6. And in molecular clouds, the magnetic field strength is a little higher, and also it covers a broad range of values, say from about 10 to maybe 3,000 microgauss. And there's also a tendency for the magnetic field strength to increase with density, approximately as the square root of density. So the alpha speed is constant in this thing. Then in ionized regions, people measure the Faraday rotation either of galactic pulsars or of extragalactic sources. It's convenient to use pulsars because in the case of a pulsar, you can measure both the Faraday rotation and also you can get a dispersion measure. And by taking the ratio of the rotation measure divided by the dispersion measure, you directly get the line of sight component of the magnetic field on average, between the source and the observer. And so now, at the present time, there are maybe several hundreds of pulsars for which we have rotation and dispersion measures, and that's enough to start trying to map out the distribution of the magnetic field in the galaxy. So from this, we now know that the magnetic field has a regular component of about 1.5 microgauss, and also a turbulent component of about 5 microgauss, so about 3 times more. These values are applied to the vicinity of the Sun. We know that the regular component of the field is nearly horizontal and predominantly azimuthal in most of the disk, at least away from the galactic center. We know that also that the magnetic field, okay, the B phi is dominant, but it cannot have the same sign everywhere. It has to have reversals in the direction of the azimuthal field, at least in the disk. Finally, in the general interstellar medium, we can use synchrotron emission measurements. Well, as you know, synchrotron emission is produced by cosmic ray electrons that generate about magnetic field lines. And so the synchrotron emissivity depends on both the cosmic ray electron density and the magnetic field strength. So if we knew one of these two quantities, we could infer the other one from the measured synchrotron emissivity. But in practice, neither quantity is very well known. So what people do is they make the standard double assumption that first, the cosmic ray electrons represent a fixed fraction of the total cosmic ray population, and two, that cosmic rays and magnetic fields are in equipartition. And in that case, they can infer both the cosmic ray pressure and the magnetic field strength from the measured synchrotron emissivity. And in this manner, they find that near the Sun, the total magnetic field strength is about 5 microgauss, and it goes up to about 7 in the molecular ring. They can also get the global spatial distribution of the field, and for instance, what you get in the vicinity of the Sun is this. So these are the cosmic ray and the magnetic pressures as functions of galactic height, so distance above the galactic plane, near the Sun. And for comparison, this is the gas pressure. And as you can see, I mean, the three pressures have comparable values near the midplane, but you can see that the gas pressure falls off very, very rapidly. And above maybe a couple hundred parsecs or so, cosmic ray pressure and magnetic pressure are both dominant. So that means really that magnetic fields are dynamically dominant, dynamically important in the interstellar medium, especially at high Z. Now, near the galactic center, there's evidence that the situation is completely different. And here the story started in the 80s with the discovery of non-thermal systems of radio continuum filaments. So these filaments basically run perpendicular to the disk, and they pass through the disk with very little distortion. So first, their morphology suggests that they just follow magnetic field lines. And this is confirmed by a radio polarization measurement, supposing this is synchrotron emission, which shows that the magnetic field in the filaments is indeed parallel to their long axis. So from these filaments, we know that the local magnetic field is perpendicular to the galactic plane. Now, it's possible to estimate the magnetic field strength in these filaments through a dynamical argument. And the idea is that because these filaments stay straight all along their length, that means that their magnetic pressure has to be strong enough to withstand the ramp pressure from the surrounding molecular clouds. And in this manner, you can obtain a lower limit on the magnetic field strength on the order of 1 milligauss. So that's like much higher than the milligauss fields that you find in the disk. On the other hand, there's another way you can estimate the magnetic field strength in the filaments, and that's based on radio synchrotron intensity measurements. So again, if you make the assumption of equipartition, then you find that the magnetic field strength is more on the order of 100 microgauss, say between 50 and 200. So there is a factor of 10 discrepancy between these two estimates. So that's for the filaments. Now, in the general interstellar medium, well, there have been measurements of the diffuse synchrotron emission. And again, if you assume equipartition, you find that the magnetic field strength is about 10 microgauss. So this is much closer to what is found in the disk. And finally, in dense molecular clouds, again, close to the galactic center, there have been measurements, I mean, far infrared submillimeter polarization measurements. So supposing this is dust thermal emission, and these measurements show that in these dense clouds, the magnetic field is nearly parallel to the galactic plane. So you see that there is a big difference between what this phenomenon suggests and what is found inside molecular clouds. And also, there are large discrepancies on the field strength. So I think nobody has ever come up with a consistent picture to explain all this. There are ideas, but I mean, here are the observational facts. And then we can discuss interpretation maybe later on. So I think that's all I needed to say. Oh, okay, for our galaxy. Now, what is the situation in external galaxies? Well, that depends on whether we're talking about spiral galaxies or elliptical. But in both cases, most of the information we have comes from synchrotron emission measurements, both the total emission, which gives you the total magnetic field strength on the plane of the sky, and polarized emission, which gives you the strength and the direction of the large-scale magnetic field. And then there have also been some Faraday rotation studies. So in the case of spiral galaxies, first we know that all of them have a large-scale regular magnetic field. Also, the total field strength is on the order of a few microgauss, as in our galaxy. Then regarding the direction, well, if we look at edge-on galaxies, we find that the regular magnetic field tends to be generally horizontal in the disk, but it can have a significant vertical component in the halo. For instance, there are a number of external galaxies where, if this is the plane, in the halo, the field tends to do something like this. So it has like an X shape. Otherwise, if you look at face-on spiral galaxies, you find that the regular field generally follows the spiral arms. So I think I have a couple of pictures to illustrate this. Yeah, this is an edge-on galaxy, which is seen at 2.8 centimeter total intensity. So, and superimposed on the radio map, you have small vectors that give you the direction of the magnetic field. And you see that indeed, in the plane or in the disk, the field is roughly parallel to the disk. But then in the halo, you have a significant vertical component. And then there's a case of a face-on galaxy. That's M51. That's like the textbook case, you know. Again, you have a map. Now, this one is taken at 6 centimeters. You can clearly see the spiral arms. And then again, the small vectors give you the direction of the magnetic field. And you can see that indeed the magnetic field tends to follow the spiral arms. So this is for spiral galaxies. Now for ellipticals, the situation is different. Well, you use the same tools to estimate the magnetic fields there. But there you find that there's no large-scale regular fields. There is only a small-scale turbulent magnetic field. Otherwise, the total magnetic field strength is again on the order of a few microgauss. Okay, so that's it for the observations. Now we're going to move on to the origin of magnetic fields. So the first idea that comes to mind is, well, could galactic magnetic fields simply be of primordial origin? Well, if that is the case, then you have to assume that the universe contains a magnetic field before the formation of galaxies. And then this magnetic field would be compressed in the following way. Can you see that, the field lines? Well, supposedly there is here a proto-galaxy, a spherical volume, which is very faint. That's the proto-galaxy. The field lines are here. And then you can see that at the time when the proto-galaxy collapses in a disk, the field lines get compressed together with the gas, and they will be compressed in this thin disk. So at the end of this compression phase, the field lines are in the disk and they are nearly horizontal. And then in a second step, the differential rotation of the galaxy will stretch these field lines in the azimuthal direction and wrap them up above the galactic center in this manner. So that's a top view, of course, of the galactic disk. That's at the beginning. That's what you would get after maybe one rotation. That's what you get after 10 rotations. And then at the present time, our galaxy has rotated maybe 50 or 100 times. So you should get something like this, but even more tightly wrapped up. I try to plot it, but then it comes out all green, so you can't see anything anyways. But the thing is this scenario realistic? Well, first, do you get enough amplification in this matter? Well, in the first step here, by the collapse, you can increase the magnetic field strength by a factor of maybe 10 to the 4. Then here, since the galaxy has rotated, say, 100 times, you gain another factor of 100. So it's like 10 to the 6, a million altogether. And that could potentially be enough to explain the microgauss fields, depending on what field you start with. But the problem is different. The problem is that this does not correspond at all to what is observed. You can see in this picture that the field lines turn 50 or 100 times about the galactic center. But I showed you from observations that magnetic field lines tend to follow the spiral arms, and so presumably they rotate, maybe they turn maybe 2 or 3, maybe 4 times above the center, but not 100 times. So you see that there is a problem here. However, there is a way of resolving this problem, and this is to invoke magnetic diffusion. Because if you have magnetic diffusion, then the gas can rotate 100 times, and the field lines can lag behind and maybe rotate only 2 or 3 times. But, and that's really where the problem is, if you invoke magnetic diffusion and you assume that it's efficient enough to avoid this tight wrapping up problem, then you have to accept that magnetic diffusion also acts perpendicular to the disk, and in that case, all the field that you produce just diffuses away. So that's really the reason why galactic magnetic fields cannot simply be primordial. If you don't have any diffusion, then you get a very tightly wrapped up spiral, which is not realistic. And if you do have diffusion, then you get rid of all the field that you produce. So this reasoning shows that, first, galactic magnetic fields cannot simply be primordial, and that there must be an additional mechanism. And that brings me to dynamo theory, of course. Well, as you all know, in dynamo theory, there is indeed an additional mechanism, which is the alpha effect. So it's due to small-scale cyclonic turbulent motion, and it generates magnetic field in the direction perpendicular to the prevailing field. So what do we get in the case of galaxies? Well, it is believed, or at least it has been suggested, that the main source of turbulence in galaxies is the explosion of supernovae. So what do you get, say, if you have just one explosion occurring in the galactic plane? So this is, again, a top view of the galactic disk. The center is here. The whole thing rotates this way. And suppose that here, at this point, you have a supernova going off. So the explosion will drive an outward propagating shockwave into the interstellar medium. This shockwave will sweep up all the ambient interstellar gas and field lines, which will collapse into a thin shell here. In addition, because everything occurs in a rotating environment, the Coriolis force will act on the diverging motions and will cause the whole thing to counter-rotate with respect to galactic rotation. And so the field lines, like follow this middle field line, the field lines will be lifted by the explosion and then twisted by the Coriolis force. And you can see that this twisting will generate magnetic field in the direction perpendicular to the initial field, that is, in this direction. And you can see that, like, in this region, which has been lifted by the explosion and which is high above the plane, in this direction, the new field is outwards, whereas in these regions, which are close to the plane, the new field is inwards. And so, and that's what the alpha effect is all about, with this twisting, you manage to produce magnetic field in the direction perpendicular to the initial field, and this new field has one sign above, way above the plane, and the opposite sign near the plane. So now, if we put everything together, this is the standard picture of how the dynamo works. So it works under the combined effect of these two complementary mechanisms. The first one is, again, the azimuthal stretching of field lines by the galactic differential rotation, like this. And, of course, this mechanism is very efficient in galaxies, and it amplifies the azimuthal component of the field. And then the second mechanism is the alpha effect, which is due to small-scale cyclonic turbulence, and which produces magnetic field in the direction perpendicular to the prevailing field, which, because of this efficient mechanism here, is in the azimuthal direction. So basically, the alpha effect will produce field in the colloidal direction. But then, in putting these two mechanisms together, you are able to amplify galactic magnetic fields very efficiently, exponentially at first. And then, of course, when the magnetic field comes into equipartition with turbulence, then the magnetic field will have a back reaction on the flow, in particular on these turbulent motions which are responsible for the alpha effect, and that will, because of that, the growth of the field will saturate. In the particular case of the turbulent motions we're talking about, what happens is that once the field grows and reaches significant values, then magnetic pressure in the surrounding medium here will increase. As a result, the expansion will just become more difficult, and it will stop earlier. And that's because these things tend to expand until their expansion velocity drops to the ambient signal speed, by which I mean the generalized sound speed, including gas pressure, magnetic pressure, and also cosmic ray pressure. So if you increase the magnetic field strength here in the external medium, then, of course, you increase the signal speed, and so these remnants will stop expanding earlier, with the result that their radius will be smaller, their lifetime will be smaller, and altogether they will decrease their contribution to the alpha effect. So in this manner, alpha is quenched, and the growth of the magnetic field saturates. So that's how things happen in the case of galaxies. Okay, so that's basically how the dynamo works. Now, what I would like to do is just say a few words about the seed magnetic field that is necessary to trigger this whole amplification process. So here, there are different possibilities. I'm not a specialist, I'm not an expert, but I'm going to list a number of possibilities, and then, you know, you can make your choice. The very first possibility would simply be that the universe was born with a magnetic field. Well, I have to say, many people don't like this idea. And in addition, if it's true that the universe was born with a magnetic field, then there exist observational limits on such a cosmological magnetic field, which are on the order of 10 to the minus 9 Gauss. That's not very stringent. Then there is another possibility that exotic processes during a phase transition in the early universe generated the very first magnetic field. Here, I have to say I don't really understand much about these exotic processes. And apparently, they manage to yield only very, very tiny magnetic fields. But I mean, maybe there's some hope there. I don't know. Now, something which has been worked on a lot is the possibility that some kind of battery effect operated before the recombination epoch, maybe in cosmological shocks or in ionization fronts, you know, which propagated at the period of reionization. This battery effect can generate magnetic fields starting from scratch on the order of, say, between 10 to the minus 20 and 10 to the minus 18 Gauss. So very tiny compared to what we observe now in galaxies. In the same manner, you could have a battery effect operating either during or at the time around the time of proto-galaxy collapse. And again, you can get the same kind of field strength. And finally, the last possibility I will mention is that the very first magnetic fields could have been produced in the first generation of stars or inside active galactic nuclei and then be ejected into the ambient and interstellar medium. So we have there a number of possibilities. I'm not sure what the answer is, but at least there are ways to produce the very first magnetic field, and then once you have seed field, your dynamo will act upon it and amplify it. Okay, now the last part is what I would like to do is discuss a number of models of galactic dynamos. Well, obviously, a very convenient way to model galactic dynamos is to use mean field dynamo theory. So just as a quick reminder for all of you, what you do is you start from the induction equation. You break up the velocity field, and likewise for the magnetic field, into a mean component and a turbulent component. And then you take the average, and you obtain the mean field dynamo equation, which is an evolution equation for the large scale or the mean magnetic field. And it has contributions from, first, the large-scale velocity field, from turbulence, and then you have this molecular contribution, which is really tiny in the case of galaxies. Now, in practice, the large-scale velocity field is taken from observations or from global mass models of galaxies which are adjusted to match the observations. The turbulent, the contribution from turbulence, is more difficult to estimate. Well, this quantity, which is the turbulent electromotive force, is usually written in terms of the mean magnetic field and its first spatial derivative with the help of two tensors, the alpha tensor, which of course is responsible for the alpha effect, and then this magnetic diffusivity tensor, which Axel talked about this morning. So what you need now, the whole trick now, is of course to estimate alpha and beta. So what you need to do this is a model of interstellar turbulence, and then you can calculate alpha and beta. So in the 80s and 90s, there have been several groups, well, including Axel and other people, who tried to solve this equation. Well, at the very beginning, people tried to solve it analytically. We got in very simple situations. Then there have been a lot of numerical solutions of this equation. And what I would like to do now is show you the main results obtained by the solutions, well, by solving this equation. And I will start by the linear solutions, so those obtained when the large-scale velocity field and the dynamo tensors, alpha and beta, do not depend on the magnetic field. Well, first, what is the overall, the global configuration of the field? Well, what is found is that in the disk of galaxies, well, the azimuthal field is always dominant. And that is because the differential rotation is so strong in galaxies. The radial field is typically on the order of a tenth of the azimuthal field, or globally. And the vertical field, that perpendicular to the disk, is even smaller. Now, I showed you that observationally, we see reversals in B5. So is it possible to reproduce these reversals? Well, the answer is yes. First, if you consider a non-axisymmetric mode, that's easy to do. But also, if you consider an axisymmetric mode, provided you have, for instance, a very strong vertical shear. But the important thing is that it is possible to reproduce these reversals that are observed. Then, near the galactic center and in the halo, it's a little different. You can still get large B5 if you have strong differential rotation. But near the galactic center, you've got to be careful because you have highly non-circular motions. Well, there's a bar near the center of the galaxy which causes highly non-circular motions. So surely you can get very strong shear, but if you have shear, that will produce field not only in the azimuthal direction but also in the radial direction. Otherwise, in the halo, if you have a galactic wind, you can get strong or large BR and BZ. And here, there's no reason why BZ would be smaller than BR, like in the disk. So usually they are on the same order of magnitude. And that's because there you have more of a spherical geometry. Regarding the azimuthal structure of the fields, well, there, the different linear modes can be classified into axisymmetric modes with an azimuthal wave number equal to zero, bisymmetric nodes with m equal to 1, quadrisymmetric nodes, m equal to 2, and, well, usually people stop there. So there is one result that is consistently obtained by different groups, and that is that if the underlying galaxy is axisymmetric, then the axisymmetric mode is always easiest to amplify. Higher order modes can also be amplified, but generally they decay in time. Now, if there is an external disturbance, like a companion galaxy, then it can be possible sometimes to excite the bisymmetric mode. And if the underlying galaxy has a spiral or a bar, then it can be sometimes possible to excite the quadrisymmetric mode. What the observational situation is for our galaxy is not very clear. For the vertical structure of these modes, well, their modes can be classified into modes that are symmetric with respect to the midplane, symmetric in Z, so denoted with the S, and modes that are antisymmetric, denoted with the A. Now, so in the case, if you focus on asymmetric modes, you will get the S0 and the A0 modes. What is found is that in the disk, it tends to be easier to excite and to amplify the symmetric modes, or at least symmetric magnetic fields. Whereas near the galactic center and in the halo, it tends to be easier to excite antisymmetric modes. And the reason is pretty easy to understand. If you're working in a disk, then it's clear that, as we saw, the field is mainly horizontal. So it's clear that in a disk, it's easier to excite and amplify a field that has the same sign throughout the disk than a field that has opposite signs above and below the midplane. And that is a symmetric mode. So the S0 mode is like the lowest order mode. That's the one that is easiest to excite in the disk. But near the galactic center and in the halo, you have something closer to spherical geometry. So like in the sun and stars, which we'll hear about tomorrow. And there we know that it's easier to excite. The lowest order mode is just a dipole. And even if you stretch it in the azimuthal direction, you still have an antisymmetric mode. So that's why near the galactic center and in the halo, it tends to be easier to excite antisymmetric modes. Now, of course, if you consider the whole galaxy with the disk and the halo, there will be only one mode with one given parity that will have the fastest growth rate. But at the beginning, and also later in the nonlinear regime, it's possible to get a mixed S0, A0 configuration, where the symmetric, well, the field is symmetric near the disk or in the disk, and antisymmetric further away in the halo, and also near the galactic center. Regarding the temporal behavior of the field, well, we can show that under typical galactic conditions, both modes, the symmetric and the antisymmetric modes, grow monotonically with time. Normally, the symmetric mode grows a little faster. The typical e-folding time is on the order of 1 giga-year. Also, we find that the antisymmetric mode gets more easily oscillatory. And the way you can understand this is by remembering that the natural tendency is to have a dynamo wave propagating towards the equator, along lines of constant omega towards the equator. So if you have a symmetric mode, you will have like two polarities with the same sign which tend to propagate towards the equator. But once they reach the equator, they get stuck there. They cannot propagate any further, and that will stop the propagation. That's why usually symmetric modes are non-oscillatory. In contrast, if you have an antisymmetric mode, then you have these two polarities. They have opposite signs, so they tend to propagate towards the equator. Once they reach the equator, they will be able to kill each other because they have opposite signs. And so they will kill each other and make some room for the next polarity coming from further up or down. So that will make it possible for propagation to proceed. And that's why the antisymmetric mode tends to be more easily oscillatory. And by the way, that's what you find in the sun. In the sun, you have a spherical geometry, you have an antisymmetric mode, and you have an oscillatory behavior. Now, there are a number of factors that can favor the oscillatory behavior. Well, they're just mentioned here. I will not get into this. Yeah, almost done now. Everything I said, or most of what I said, applies to linear solutions. So I was going to say just a few words about non-linear solutions. And the idea is, when the field comes or approaches equipotentiation, of course, the amplification will saturate. Numerical simulations show that the final magnetic field strength, of course, is close to the equipotentiation field strength, but it can be a little more, but not more than a factor of 2. So it's on the order or a little less than 2 times the equipotentiation field. And the time saturation is, well, it depends on the seed field, of course, but it's typically several gigayears. Now, you can also see that in the nonlinear regime, the final spatial configuration of the field will be smoother, and that is simply because if you are in the linear regime, well, you know that the field will grow stronger in some specific regions, but it is precisely in those regions where the field grows fastest that quenching will occur first, and that will slow down further increase of the field in these regions. And at the same time, the field will keep growing in the surrounding regions. So in the end, the final configuration will be better. And finally, in the nonlinear regime, you can have, of course, nonlinear interactions between different modes. And these interactions sometimes make it possible to amplify modes that would have decayed away in the linear regime, or they make it possible sometimes for the field to evolve towards a configuration which does not have the preferred linear simulations in Z. So these nonlinear interactions can sometimes modify the final parity or symmetry of the field. And finally, well, I think that one slide stayed in Toulouse, so 14th of July surprise. I just wanted to add a few things about direct numerical simulations. So here, what I did was just present solutions of the mean field dynamo equation. But recently, people have started trying to perform direct numerical simulations of galactic dynamos. So I think these simulations are still at a very early stage. Well, first, they are done only on a box, on a region of the galaxy, a small box, which is typically 1 kiloparsec in size, maybe a little more in the vertical direction. So that's a good start, but that's not enough. In the end, we will want to simulate the whole galaxy. The other problem is also that these simulations still have a limited dynamical range. So they are unable to reach down to very small scales. And we know that very interesting things are happening at small scales. So I don't think we can claim that they are realistic at the present time. For the moment, they are able to reproduce field amplification, which is a good start. And also, the amplification rate tends to be a little higher than what is predicted by the mean field dynamo equation. Typically, people find something between maybe 200 to 300 megayears as opposed to 1 gigayear. So that's a little faster. But other than that, I think these direct numerical simulations have not given any new information, anything new that we didn't know from the mean field dynamo equation. But as I said, it's a start. And I think it's the way to go. There's a lot of hope, a lot of room for improvement, and a lot of hope in these simulations. And I will stop there. Thanks.
Questions?
Two questions. The first one is that we know galaxies are warped, they have a warp, so you expect them to have a dominant of m equal 1 eventually in this warp, or m equal 2. So I was wondering how this will change the picture if you were taking into account the fact that they are not purely axisymmetric as you were describing them, but warped.
Yeah. Well, warping is one thing, but dynamo action really takes place in the inner parts of the galaxy, and the warp is more significant outwards. So I don't know that the warp would be that significant. But what would be, I think, much more significant is the underlying spiral structure. I mean, these axisymmetric simulations just assume an axisymmetric galaxy. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they find that the axisymmetric mode is easier to amplify. Now, in some simulations, spiral structure has been added, and then sometimes you manage to excite the m equal to 2 mode. I suppose, I don't know of anybody who has included the warp, but my impression is that if you did it, it wouldn't make much of a difference, I don't think, for the reason I said.
Okay, and the other thing is that you said that most of the alpha effect will come from supernova blowing up.
The
alpha effect will come from the blowing up of supernova. So this should be quite sparse in the galaxy and not regular. So this simulation, I suppose, we assume an alpha effect which is homogeneously distributed in Dynamo, where you will expect that to be perhaps not inhomogeneous in a real. Perhaps the 3D simulation, the Dirac simulation, could have something like that, you know, non-homogeneous alpha effect. And how are they computed right now?
Yeah, well, first, when you have an explosion, it seems like it's a very localized event. But in fact, the supernova remnant can grow out to distances of tens of parsecs, maybe 100. And in addition, if you have a large number of supernovae exploding in a given region, then you will produce a superbubble which can go out to maybe 1 kiloparsec, much larger. And in fact, at a given point in the galaxy, you keep having supernova shocks going by, you know. So to you, it looks like it's very inhomogeneous, which it is. The interstellar medium is extremely inhomogeneous, but it's like turbulent motions. They go on all the time. It's not like one explosion, nothing. A long time later, another explosion. They go out all the time. Now, the direct simulations I was talking about do exactly that. They take a box, and then they have supernova going off in this box and releasing energy, and they just follow what happens, and they get amplification. But you're right, the alpha effect is very spiky.
More questions? Just 2 points. One is that I'd be interested in your comments on the fact that I guess the observations don't show reversals in other galaxies, but we do see them in our galaxy, is just one point. And then the second point is, I think you with Han have the only paper maybe that tried to get the small-scale magnetic field spectrum of the galaxy, and I just would be interested in your comments on where that research stands now and what you found.
Yeah, we haven't really worked on this anymore. But first, for the first point, regarding the reversals, I mean, there's still a lot of debate on this. There are different groups working with different data, of course, but all based on rotation measures. And it seems to me like everybody agrees on the fact that in the disk, just in the disk, you have reversals, but they do not agree on the number of reversals and on their positions. For instance, a conservative group, Brown et al., find that you need to have at least one reversal, but they don't find any need to have much more. Han, on the other hand, finds that you need to have a reversal at every interface between an arm and the inner arm region. So that's a lot of reversals. So I don't really know what the answer is. I think it's still very uncertain, maybe because we just don't have enough pulsars, and also because the structure of the interstellar magnetic field has, you know, very big inhomogeneities. So maybe, you know, what is exactly the large-scale field? We don't know. So, and it's true that if you observe external galaxies, you don't see these reversals. I'm not sure where that is. Okay, and the other thing was, the spectrum of magnetic fields, Binter and Spengler did some work, I think in 96, they published a paper on the magnetic spectrum in the interstellar medium, but at small scales. And they found something close to a Kolmogorov spectrum. We found something much flatter, but we're talking about large scales. And that's, you know, in Axel's talk, you have this spike where you have energy injection, maybe at 100 parsec or so, and then you can go to larger scales. So this is not really a turbulent spectrum, but that's just the spectrum of the observed fluctuations, you know. And we find a slope which is about minus 37 or so. So it's much flatter than Kolmogorov. It's small. It's a few hundred parsec up to 10, 15 kiloparsec.
I'd like to speak out on behalf of the unwashed stars. Galaxies have like our own 200 billion stars, and it's very nice that you have supernovae that go off, but probably all of these stars are building fields, and Axel told us at length this morning that they lose their fields and their magnetic helicity to be able to do things well. What do you think is the role of all the small scale, on the galactic scale, building of fields by all the stars that are going on continuously? How do they contribute to the flavor of the larger scale fields that are eventually emerging in galaxies?
Well, I think that, you mean the stellar magnetic fields that are injected into the interstellar medium, for instance? Yeah. If you work it out, that's a very small contribution. So if you take one stellar magnetic field and then eject it into the interstellar medium and spread it out on the volume per star, then you find a very tiny contribution. It's very small compared to the actual magnetic field. But it's still a small contribution. I think the dynamo will work on it and try to get some mean field out of it. But again, all these contributions are small.
But by comparison with seed field estimates, of course, it's big.
If we're talking about the seed field, it's big because you can really start from this and amplify. But compared to what the field is now, it's small.
I have a question about this origin of the alpha effect, as you described it, due to the expanding shells. And I would agree with Sasha. I would think that maybe it's another contribution to the alpha effect in turbulent diffusion comes not from these localized expanding shells, but from the pervasive turbulence. And I would think that maybe 90%, well, the contribution from turbulence is a factor of 10 larger than directly from expanding shells.
You mean the turbulence in the vicinity of the shocks?
No, pervasive turbulence in the interstellar medium, which is directly observable. And it contributes of the order of 1 kilometer per second to the alpha effect. Meanwhile, expanding shells contribute 0.1 kilometer per second, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing about this,
only 10% of the total.
Yeah, well, I think the nice thing about these explosions is that they give a very systematic contribution. It's a very nice expansion, then counter-rotation, so it always works in the same way, and that's why it's efficient. Now, maybe you have another estimate, and it's also to illustrate how the thing works, but of course you can have other sources of turbulence.
Yeah. And another thing is that vertical dependence of magnetic field and other pressures, that magnetic field, you said, can become dynamically dominant in large heights above the disk.
Compared to the gas.
Yes, but did you include the pressure from the turbulence and thermal pressure from the halo? Because I thought that the pressure scale height in the disk is 3 kiloparsec.
Right.
So, because the gas there is diluted but very hot, million degrees, and it can have turbulent velocities of the order of 100 kilometers per second. It can make the station less dramatic, definitely. So I would think that maybe magnetic fields will hardly dynamically dominant at large regions, maybe, even at high large
Well, the sharp drop in gas pressure that you saw is because there's pressure associated with the cool phases of the interstellar medium, and those, of course, are confined to the disk. But I included a contribution from the warm ionized medium and from the hot gas with a scale height of, say, 3 kiloparsec. But I guess you're right. It's only thermal pressure for the hot gas, and it also has a turbine contribution, which would increase things. But I still think that way up there, magnetic fields are dominant. You don't think so?
This is a rather general question. Is there anything that we can learn about magnetic fields by studying remote galaxies, like quasars or very, very far galaxies?
There have been a number of very young galaxies, not directly observed, but observed through the absorption lines they produce in quasars. And there have been some measurements of further rotation in a number of those galaxies, very young galaxies. The thing is, you have further rotation, you have to subtract off the contribution from our own galaxy, the contribution maybe from intervening things, and maybe from the source itself. But there are two sources where there is clearly a Faraday contribution coming from the young galaxy itself. And surprisingly, it's a pretty big magnetic field. It gives a magnetic field on the order of 1 microgauss or so, which means that this kind of magnetic field strength were already reached at a very young time. So, and that puts a very strong constraint on the dynamo. But I mean, I think there have been different suggestions, but apparently only two of those galaxies seem to really have, for sure, a strong magnetic field.
Okay, let us thank you again.